everybody, and welcome to the Publishing and New Technologies panel conversation. My name's Ralph Crane, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this panel discussion. Now, we particularly want to keep this session as informal as possible, so we're going to avoid any temptation to present you with a series of short mini-lectures, and instead, we're going to try and have a real conversation over the next 45 minutes or so. But before we start that conversation, I'd like to take the opportunity to ask each of my three panelists to introduce themselves to you so that you hear their voices before we start the conversation. We'll start on my left with Sarah Howell.
I'm Sarah. I'm currently one of the co-directors for the National Young Writers Festival, and I have a kind of background in making small zines, specifically comics and blogging. So I've worked on a number of sort of new media projects and festivals. That's my primary background, yeah.
And then sitting next to Sarah, we have Craig Norris.
Thanks, Ralph. Craig Norris from the University of Tasmania. I'm a lecturer there as well as doing research. A lot of my work pertains to social networks and individuals and collectives and groups that are using social networks to further their dreams, ambitions, and dystopias often. So that's kind of the research and lecturing I do.
And at the far end with the red microphone, we have Therese Fingleton.
Hi. So I work at the Australia Council for the Arts. I'm the digital strategy project manager lately. Previously, I've been working with literature for the last 2.5 years on a program called Story of the Future, which is working with writers who are interested in writing in new forms, writing for new platforms, publishing across different kinds of media. So I'll talk a little bit about that through the talk, I imagine. But and my background is kind of from a geeky, technical kind of side of things, but always working within the arts and creative industries.
My background isn't geeky or technical at all. So I want to start off this conversation about publishing and new technologies by thinking about books. And first of all, we'd like to consider that vexed issue of the future of the book in the age of new technologies. And I want to say right at the outset, rather than posing the question, I want to say to you, we are all agreed there is a future for the book in the age of new technologies. It's just what form that future is going to take that interests us. Sarah, maybe I can start off with asking you a question. How do you think the emergence of print-on-demand books has impacted on those traditional large print runs that we've been used to seeing?
I think it's impacted in that we're not seeing the large traditional print runs as much. Unless it's a Stephen King guaranteed, you know, bestseller, a lot more publishers are going for print-on-demand because it reduces a lot of the risk to them. Probably need to explain print-on-demand a little bit. Yes, there's some nods in the audience. So basically, you have traditional offset printing, which takes a lot of time to set up that offset printing, and it costs a lot of money. But you can do a large print run, and the larger your print run, the greater the economies of scale, the cheaper your individual unit will be, the larger your print run is. But of course, the smaller your print run is, the more expensive it becomes because of the initial large cost. What digital printing technology offers is a faster and cheaper setup cost, which means that people can create books on a smaller print run and have a cheaper per unit cost than you would have for offset printing. Of course, once you get to your larger scales, it is still cheaper to do it with offset printing than it is with digital printing. So this has opened up a whole range of new industries, mostly online, where you have a couple of different styles of industries that have grown up around this. You have stuff that's for a mass audience, so you've got companies that will offer to the general public the ability to print their own book. They just have to upload PDFs or such, and they can print their own book quite easily. And these companies offer a whole range of distribution services around this core service of printing your book. So you can say you want to create your own little children's book, quite simple little book, or even, you know, a family memento, little photo album or a calendar. this whole range of formats, but you can simply create that, put it online, and anyone around the world can order that book, have it printed and posted to them. So you don't have stacks and stacks of books under your bed for years on end while you're waiting to distribute them and get them out there. The other side of the industry is that actual publishers are using it more and more. So they'll either have it in-house as a small publisher, so they'll have the technology in-house, or they'll outsource it to a book wholesaler who will have that technology. Does that sort of answer for people what that is? In answer to your original question, it will create more mass audiences. You'll have a lot of dross out there, a lot of, you know, very run-of-the-mill little, you know, vanity projects. But you'll also have a lot more competition. You'll also have a lot more interesting books, a lot more niche books, a lot more variety. So in many cases, many respects, it's actually bringing books to life a lot more, because you'll have access to a far greater quantity of books than you ever have.
Teresa Craig, do you want to come in on print-on-demand?
Well, I was just thinking, from our perspective, I guess thinking about it as with the Literature Board kind of hat on, for us the big opportunity for print-on-demand is really for small publishers and who publish niche titles. And so, every year we give publishing grants, which may be, you know, small amounts, up to maybe $8,000, $5,000, to small niche, often like poetry titles or basically titles that are, you know, economically unviable to be published without assistance. And we're looking at that program now and thinking how can those small publishers use print-on-demand technologies so that just to be a bit more sustainable, so that they're not trying to get grants from us or trying to get assistance to allow them to print, make up the numbers in a print run. So, you know, it's a minimum, like printers will say, well, it's a minimum of 500 or it's a minimum of 1,000. So rather than those publishers being constrained by printing, you know, 1,000 books that maybe they're not going to have a market for, that they can focus on, if they can use this technology to kind of free them of those restraints. And so that's, I think that's going to open up a lot of opportunities for smaller and niche publishers who have previously been constrained by this need to make up an artificial print run number.
I mean, also, of course, some of the large publishers are using print on demand to keep a title in print. Even if it's not actually available in the shops, it means you can order any title from their back catalogue and they will run off a single copy, which means, of course, for the author, that book never goes out of print. The author can never get copyright of the book back and can never negotiate distribution with another publisher.
It does have other implications. Yeah, absolutely. And it does, so in some ways, may disadvantage an author, but also advantage authors. And, an interesting thing that came up last year, we were doing a roundtable on literature and education, and some of the teachers and people involved were saying, we don't have these classic Australian works on our reading program because we can't get them. Because we're living in Toowoomba or wherever, and we can't. Our bookshop doesn't have them, or they're out of print. So there really is no excuse for works to go out of print with print on demand. But as you say, that can be great for reviving some of the kind of classics that are out of print. But obviously, can have implications for writers and their rights deals with publishers as well.
So really, print on demand is something that is an opportunity for small presses. And there are also some interesting opportunities for some of the large presses. Print-on-demand certainly doesn't suggest that we're going to lose the large print runs. And I wonder, if I turn to you for a minute, Craig, I wonder if the fact that print-on-demand is not replacing large print runs and so on, is that perhaps a sign that this talk about new technologies and the death of the book, that it's really been overhyped?
Yeah, I think in many ways it's a great example of that. The hype with new media, and particularly, I guess, by hype, what we can look at are the kind of utopic dreams and dystopic fears that have surrounded some of the discussion about new media and books today. So utopic dreams, so that either individual publishers or publications are going to be able to reach a massive audience just by setting up the kind of nuts and bolts to engage with an audience. And that's misleading. It's not going to lead to success just having the trappings of online internet communication with your publication. At the same time, new media is not going to result in the abandonment of the book. It's not going to mean we're in a paperless society and the book no longer exists. And I think the concern with hype is overinvestment into publishing companies which are only branding themselves as being thriving in an online environment or thriving still in an old-fashioned environment. I think there's kind of hybrid moments now occurring where they're existing in both spaces. I guess the main point to make about hype and not believing the hype is the idea of the black box fallacy of any communication or technology, the belief that if you simply put this black box in front of anyone, it'll lead to either wonderful opportunities or horrible disasters. So, for example, we can see it a lot in education policies with laptops. So if we get laptops into our schools, it'll lead automatically to education revolution and this kind of broadband-enabled kind of enlightenment moment. And it's not the case. I mean, that black box, whatever it is, isn't automatically going to generate these kind of ideal, these utopias or dystopias. So what we have are these wonderful middle grounds opening up, these kind of reflections back on a lot of the hype which was driving, stock prices going up in new media companies and so forth. So there's a lot of reconsideration. What are the actual outcomes? What are the proofs that this works? There's some really great case studies now emerging where, like print on demand or the role of Amazon.com to lead to publishing phenomenons in the book world are now being shown. And there's new terminology growing up from actual proofs happening on how, online communication or online fan cultures are helping, change what we think the success of a text is. So not measuring it by a blockbuster opening weekend kind of idea, but by measuring it by the kind of reality of the media environment we live in today, that other media texts can bounce off media texts to suddenly create renewed interest in texts which previously might have gone out of date or out of print, sorry. But now there can be this kind of enlivened interest in them, so they can be republished because maybe there was a movie done on a Dickens novel, or there was a movie done on a Shakespeare novel, which kind of leads to all this renewed interest. I mean, Shakespeare and Dickens will never go out of print, but there are texts that sadly might. But, a movie based on them might trigger this enormous interest. And the long tail economic theory is the theory under which this premise is based, that we can measure success particularly for cult commodities rather than a short-term kind of financial reward by a much longer kind of social impact. That also registers the fact that cinema is involved in the success of books today as well as radio, as well as, online sources.
Does anybody else want to come in on that?
Just on the hype, I would just add that books are the most bought item on the internet, so it isn't all hype. And they may not necessarily, a lot of those books that make up that figure may be DIY, renovate your house books. But it does mean that print culture and book culture is very much alive, and a lot of that has got to do with really good e-commerce platforms that are easy to use and that kind of thing. And publishers need to think about those kinds of services to be able to offer those kinds of services to constituents.
I guess those big internet companies, they are the new technologies for publishing. It's not just print on demand, or that is a new technology that publishers can make use of. And maybe publishers, as you say, have to start rethinking their role a little bit. And maybe I can ask this question of you, Therese. I mean, do you think publishers are going to have to start reconsidering their role? So that perhaps they stop thinking of themselves simply as book publishers, as they probably have done up to now, and maybe start thinking of themselves more as content publishers?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there are a few reasons that are kind of coming together to make publishers start to shift in their thinking, and it's the same the same issues that are being faced by cinema, film industry and print media, newspapers. So if you look at newspapers, they're not about printing newspapers, it's about publishing news. And so I think publishers who start to pick up on these different forms will, be ahead of the head of the pack. There are a few different reasons. There's firstly, writers want to write in different forms other than books, and obviously writers have written, they write across all sorts of media, and for radio and performance and all sorts of things. But now there's a whole big expanded canvas, I think you referred to it as, which was a lovely statement, a lovely phrase, of places where and ways that writers want to write. And they don't want to be constrained by writing for the print version only. We've worked with a few writers who are writing books that have, you know, there's one in particular that's a trilogy series for teenage girls, and it's a main part of the book is the blog that the main character in the book is keeping, and the blog is very much part of the story. So it's not just a marketing tool. It's very much real time. As you're reading the story, you have to go onto the blog and find out what's happened, and you know, and you can post comments and things like that. And this, you know, writer reflected on how it's having that freedom to be able to explore with her character on a kind of on a live platform really helped her expand her writing as well and think about writing differently. So I think publishers will at some point begin to see they need to respond to the art form, because I think I'm talking, I suppose, about, you know, literature and the kinds of writing that I know best. But I think the content will dictate the form. So people won't be writing content just because they want to write a book. Some people will, but they'll be writing content because they want to write the content, and then they'll think about what form it should take. I think also it's a good thing for publishers to think about the fact that content is much more malleable and travels farther than a book. So while a book is never going to go out of fashion as far as I'm concerned, and the tangible and physicalness of a book is what makes it so wonderful and unique and thing that you want to hold on to, it also limits, you know, that content to being on those pages in that book. And I might be able to give it to you and you can read it and give it back to me. But if it's in digital form, content can go anywhere. And, of course, that throws up all sorts of other questions about rights and things like that. But if I have a story that I want to tell, it can be maybe published in a book, but it could also work quite well as an interactive game. And I think if publishers don't think about writers thinking in that way, then writers are going to want to hang on to their digital rights and not just sign over their rights at the time of signing their publishing deal. And they'll look at, okay, who will publish this digital version for me? And so book publishers who are thinking books only, I think, are doing themselves out of, you know, good business.
Are you thinking publishers will be considering the digital game, for example, at the same time as they consider the more traditional book? Or is there
some? I hope so. I mean, I think they should be. I've just had a meeting out there with a couple of writers from here who I've been working with for the last few years on a project. And that's essentially what they need. Their content is very much publisher's content, but they need a publisher who is awake to the possibilities of this being a cross-platform project, because it should be.
Because hasn't it been more the case in the past that the book comes out, then depending on the success of the book, the film is considered, the game is considered? So you look at Lord of the Rings, you know, how long between the publication of the book and the film? Much, much longer, of course, than the release of the film and all the digital games and so on that come with it. So really you're suggesting that these different stages are compressed and all considered at the same time. So is there a danger then that some books that might otherwise have been published might not get published because there aren't those opportunities for other platforms at the same time?
I don't think we're at the stage where books would be turned down because they aren't cross-platform. Or that, do you know what I mean by cross-platform? That they aren't, you know, also having components that are published in a different media as well as a print book, so something online or, you know, we're nowhere near that stage. I think maybe some publishers might start to specialise in doing content that, you know, in printing, publishing books that also has some other kind of media component. I can't imagine that we would see books being turned down because they don't have, you know, a print component. But I think that's a long way off in the future. But I know publishers are now thinking about the book as the printed object and as an e-book, but they also need to go a step further and think about, you know, a mobile version. And it all depends on the content. And that's why the content is king, to use that phrase, but that's why the content will dictate where it should go. And some content should be published in a book and should stop there. But some of it, depending on who the audience is, and, you know, you have to take all those factors into consideration.
Sarah Craig, do you want to come in on the idea of publishers moving from being simply book publishers to content publishers?
Well, I guess I was just thinking about cult media properties and how that kind of cross-platform or transmedia slippage of content really dominates a lot of cult properties today. And that kind of simultaneous release of almost a franchise on the public through different mediums. So the example I'm thinking, it's not based in print to begin with, the Heroes TV show, which was very popular amongst many youth, was an interesting case because at the same time the TV show was coming out, they had a comic book backstory being written. They had little episodes coming out on YouTube, as well as their blog site having kind of text-based further discussion, as well as opportunities to talk to the authors. And what this represented for me is that if you have a look at how the audience responded to being given a product which was kind of cross-platformed or transmedia, was that for those people that were just casual readers of a text, they could just go into the dominant form, so the TV show or the novel in another format. But if they wanted more, if they wanted to get that kind of richer experience, the background story, you know, what happened to character X, Y, or Z, they go into those other components of the story, the comic book, you know, and we can imagine if there was a computer game that came out. I mean, all of those kind of tap into an idea of a success growing from the one text. But again, it's not an origin text. It's not like Lord of the Rings or these other moments. There was a clear sense of, you know, there was the beginning primal text, and then a few years later there was these other texts, and then two or three decades later there was the film. With these texts, it's all happening in very compressed fashion, and there's no, I mean, some of them are prioritized around a certain text, but increasingly they're not. Increasingly it's becoming quite slippery to find where that origin text is, and you know, fan culture also dovetails into that nicely, that fans also then write their own fictions based on it.
I would have said that Tolkien, if he exists now, would have
right.
totally and utterly had cross-platform.
Yeah.
Because, you look at the way he wrote, he had all the extra
yes.
paraphernalia, the Silmarillion, is that the sort of backstory stuff? So there was always, with his work, more there for the fan if they wanted to get more involved in it. So, I think particular narratives will always, the author, in fact, will always want to offer a larger world to their audience beyond that original narrative.
It's interesting you're talking about what the author would like to do there, Sarah. Maybe we've talked about the book for quite a while now, and I guess we should probably start to think a bit more about the new technologies that we said we'd discuss. Perhaps we should look at some of these new platforms that are competing with the traditional presses. And maybe I can ask a question of you, Craig, that sort of really follows on from what you've been talking about. And I'm wondering what new expectations readers have now these days. I mean, are readers expecting to be able to engage directly with an author? You know, are they expecting to be able to talk to an author through websites, through blogs? In other words, do readers now want greater interactivity, for want of a better word? Do they want to be able to interact with the author?
Expect to be able to go to their blog site and ask them a question. On page 53, you said X. Clearly that contradicts with page... I think that's a kind of nuisance fan example. But I think it does happen. And for me, the best examples are looking at how J.K. Rowling and Ursula Le Guin have managed their fans. If we look at J.K. Rowling, for instance, and the Harry Potter text, I mean, it's enormously successful. And I think J.K. Rowling has done a lot to invest into the community as well as celebrate the community support for her text. I mean, it's such a huge phenomenon. But then if you look at some cases, so, for example, there was an incident where a fan had written together an encyclopedia of J.K. Rowling's universe of Harry Potter, and it had existed online for quite a while. The fan then decided, well, you know, there's a huge body of work here. I'd like to move to print. So it worked with a publisher to move into print. J.K. Rowling and the lawyers got involved, sadly, to say, no, this is, intellectual property rights breach. There was cease and desist letters written to the website then, as well as, of course, the abandonment of the print project. And that reaction of an author to, a fan, at first kind of in the shadows of the internet, working with the content of that to create a backstory, to create an encyclopedia of that universe, but then, reaching print, becoming a kind of tipping point where, no, we have to stop this, clamp it down, is a kind of conventional response to this audience participation in the text, the idea that audiences want to, and can through a lot of new media forms, participate and have their voice heard a lot. And if we compare this to Ursula Le Guin, I'm pretty sure it's Ursula Le Guin, one of the big female sci-fi writers, maybe one, but Ursula Le Guin gave fans a kind of tacit approval for them to be the gatekeepers of the Earthsea sci-fi kind of universe she'd created. And Ursula Le Guin said, well, okay, there's a lot of continuity questions, there's a lot of fiction being written about my very deep world. I can either assume the position like J.K. Rowling has done of saying, yes, this is or isn't canon, as there are debates. So, for instance, Dumbledore was outed as being gay, but then he was outed as not being gay. And there was all these debates around, is Dumbledore gay or not? And J.K. Rowling assumed the position of saying, well, I am the author, my word is law, and kind of closed down that debate. Whereas Ursula Le Guin gave that power to a lot of fans who have set up a kind of similar online encyclopedia, and they very much have taken on the kind of canon, and they moderate all the discussions that are existing within this universe, a lot of the other fan websites. And what Ursula Le Guin has found is that those fans are actually much more kind of brutal in terms of clamping down on inappropriate usage of the text, you know, text that isn't in the spirit of how, you know, fans love the Earthsea trilogy. So, again, they're both really two really interesting cases of fabulously well-known and popular authors handling their fan cultures in very different ways. One, really wanting to control that space. The other, giving that space over, you know, not all of it, but some of it, to fans to then administer, and finding a lot of success with that still. You know, the fans get a lot of achievement and reward in terms of being recognised by the author themselves. There's also tons of examples of authors having fan fiction sites set up around the universes they create, which they even dovetail into and discuss with the fans about. I mean, John Birmingham and his Axis of Time kind of time travel story about going back to World War II sets up a whole fan universe around that. And in fact, if you go through the threads that fans have written to him in that fan site, you can see that he's actually learning a lot from the fans. There are people with backgrounds in what he's writing that go beyond what he knows. And later on, you can see that he's incorporated some of that into his text. So, yeah, again, there's positive and negative examples of these expectations and where that can lead to.
Sorry, you look like you're about to jump in there.
I was just wondering, can you think of an example where the fan influence has become too strong?
Where it's become too strong. I'm such an optimist. I got to admit, it's all this kind of celebration stuff I dwell on. Look, I can think of examples where it's become too much. I think there are examples where there's been, particularly when I'm talking about Ursula Le Guin's world and the fans themselves moderating other people's usage of the text, where particularly there's, I mean, Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea trilogy, I mean, it's such a, you know, such an important text that says something about civilization and humanity, and then you might have kind of slash fiction or fiction which is basically introducing sexual content into it. So, for instance, Harry Potter is a good example. So Harry Potter text, there's been a lot of kind of moral panic around some of the fan fiction pieces which will turn characters into having sexual relations between each other. And clearly, you know, that's not in the spirit of the enjoyment and the overall kind of capacity of that culture. But, yeah, those aspects are, I think, aspects where that kind of fan fiction aspect can, I think, be counterproductive to some people's engagement with the universe. That being said, slash fiction is a very important political tool to, I think, raise interesting questions about gender dynamics. And there are some great examples of slash fiction effectively kind of, I mean, the Dumbledore is gay question. I mean, that really sets itself up nicely as kind of being a text that maybe fans could interrogate, that the author's reluctant to, and deservedly so.
What I was also thinking about was when the sort of, I can't think of a perfect example myself, but when the original narrative is changed dramatically because of the fans' influence, that the author is starting to listen increasingly to the fans. Actually, I can't think of an example, Spike in Buffy,
right.
Where the audience love that character so much. And possibly it might have been more necessary to the story that he died earlier. Personal opinion there. But that the author is sacrificing the integrity of the narrative to please the audience.
Yeah, I mean, I think those pressures can act on an author's work from so many directions. One is from a kind of fanish enthusiasm not to let go of a character's death, even though really the kind of poetic nature of that death becomes undermined ultimately if if the character is reintroduced into the series. That concern can also come by, the editors being involved in the book and saying, look, you know, I want a happy ending. I mean, as kind of cliche as that. But
I guess there's always been that influence. It's usually been gatekept by an editor rather than direct influence between the author and the fan base.
I mean, again, I guess I'm pretty optimistic that the more minds you have working on a project, the more collective intelligence could occur positively. But again, I think there are negative examples.
That's very optimistic, Craig.
Yes.
Therese, Craig and Sarah are having their own conversation here, so perhaps we'll come back into it for a moment. Craig's talked about websites, he's talked about blogs, but there are a lot more new platforms, aren't there, and a lot more new domains, which whatever terminology you want to use, and I'm rather hesitant about the terminology. I'm not really quite sure about the technicalities of these terms. But what other new platforms and new domains are opening up for writers?
I'll help you with the terminology.
Thanks.
I wrap it up all nicely by saying it's a new writing universe. And that keeps, you know, everybody happy. Anything could happen in a new universe. So there are so many examples of different forms and different types of writing and different types of publication. You know, everything from bot fiction where, you know, computer-generated robots are, you know, generating the fiction to, you know, to more things like blogs and those kind of things. But I think some of the key areas that we'll see really emerging in the next few years are very much immersive interactive media. So if you look at games, consoles and gaming devices are so prolific now. I think it's something like 88% of Australian households have a game device. So I think we're going to see, with changes in infrastructure, hopefully soon, improved broadband services. I'm just thinking about Australia, improved broadband services and digital TV.
We're in Tasmania.
Yeah, no, I understand that. It's tricky territory to be discussing, but I think as we start to the mobile web, where, you know, data plans for mobile will come down, that kind of thing. So because we'll have better access to infrastructure and higher speeds, we're going to see, more of a take-up in this country that maybe we haven't seen before. But it's certainly looking at the UK and US and some other places, and in Asia particularly, gaming is massive. And I think that they are very potentially lucrative and really fascinating areas for writers to move into. And I've been doing a lot of work with writers who are moving into those areas. You know, and a couple of examples, one, Facade, is a game that was published in, I think, 2006 by a couple of guys in the US. And it was a critical success, but not a commercial success. So obviously it was, you know, literature. And shouldn't say that, should I? It was a really lovely game because it was almost like a piece of interactive theatre. And it was a big kind of wake-up call for the games industry because they loved it, but they, you know, it's not something that's just now kind of commercially viable. But basically it was you knock on a door and you go into an apartment and it's a couple or have invited you over for dinner and you sit down and you're having dinner with them. And they're having they're basically having an argument. And you choose different options of things that you can say at different points in the argument. And depending on the options you choose, you can, you know, end in them breaking up and having them a big row, or it can all be resolved peacefully and you can all have a wonderful evening and drink lots of wine and have a great time. And so it's all scripted, so it's pre-scripted, so it's kind of false interactivity. So, you know, you're given a list of scripted options. So that's kind of one level of kind of interactive content that writers are starting to look at, and that brings it's very much taking things like interactive theatre and, you know, interactive kind of performance into technology. And then you can go to the other kind of spectrum, end of the spectrum with games, and you have your big massively multiplayer online role-playing games. And audiences are increasingly demanding more sophisticated content, more emotional engagement. And so I think there are big opportunities for writers to bring their content into those domains. And just one other example I'll give is a project we've been working with called Virtual Shakespeare. And it's basically a lady, Corinne Ellie Harper is her name, who's been working with Bell Shakespeare for a long time. And she's a writer, director, actor, and basically a Shakespeare specialist. And she wanted to devise a workshop space, an online workshop space for Shakespeare students, so for high school and tertiary level students studying Shakespeare, so that she could have a role-playing workshop space that she could use with them without having to go to their school out in wherever it was. She does a lot of work in regional and remote Australia. And it's just, you know, it's in development at the moment, but it's this really beautiful project where you basically go in, and it's the immersion that's the really fantastic thing about it, because you go into Macbeth's head and you basically, you know, kind of explore the narrative and the different dimensions of his character by going into different kind of chambers in this space. And then there's a performance space and a workshop space, and you know, and it's a really new way to engage with a very classic text. And they're the kinds of ways that I think writing can go into new domains and potentially reach new audiences who might not necessarily pick up a play or, you know, go to a play or pick up a book, but might be online and be invited by their friends to come and play this game. Or
And who might afterwards pick up a book or see
Absolutely.
The play.
We've seen a few examples of that with some projects that we've had that are interactive, immersive, you know, 3D world projects that are have been created by one particularly created by a poet called Thursday's Fictions. And throughout the space, there's poetry kind of both projected on the walls of this space, but also the whole space is kind of written based on poetry. So you're kind of engaging with poetry throughout it. And he's had a number of comments from people who are coming in, engaging with the space and saying, I hate poetry, but this is fantastic. Can I buy your book? Where can I buy your book? Or, you know, I didn't know I loved poetry, but or I'd like poetry, but this is great. So I think that, you know, it can be a way to bring in new audiences as well.
Are there other platforms that you can think of that are attracting different audiences?
Well, I was just thinking about your own experience with comic books. I mean, one of the things I've noticed is the explosion of web comics, and I guess the web comic phenomenon being a really representative case of the impact of the internet on forms of publishing in terms of web comics. I mean, there are a lot of amateurs doing web comics. There are a lot of people that are no way professional, yet there's so many out there, and the kind of support mechanisms that give guidance, and also the level of effort you need to make to get a first start in webcomics is pretty straightforward. There's a great local artist that's doing a webcomic at the moment, 100 Days in the Life of a Guy Living in Hobart, and I think it's called Day in the Life.
Is Chris Down?
Yes, that's
yes,
it.
A Diary of a Work in Progress.
Diary of a Work in Progress. There's this guy, and he's basically writing every day a comic of his something that's happened that day. 100 days or something that he's writing?
I don't know if he set a limit to it, but he's beyond most webcomics. Most webcomics, if you're doing a diary, most people only do maybe 4 panels, yeah. So he does a whole page.
So there's this kind of professional amateurism coming from Chris's work. Then there's also people like Madeline Rosker, who's a Hobart-based manga artist, who's managed to start off in these kind of fan communities to run comics, getting stuff posted, and then got a the Southern Seas publication publishers to publish their comic books overseas now. I mean, you can get them in the US much easier than you can get them here in Hobart, sadly. So,
there's definitely a lot more in terms of support for the comics community and zine makers as well. There's a lot since the 90s and the internet. Zine making probably dropped off. Probably it was big in the 80s and 70s, the punk culture, and then it kind of dropped off, and then it picked up again with the internet because there was a means for community to build again and therefore distribution. So it's really kind of picking up and becoming more popular again now because of that. And then that's an example, again, of a physical object and the power that the internet has to distribute a physical object. But for me, the most interesting stuff is, again, touching on what Therese was saying, is actually the real-life manifestations of these technologies. So the theatre game with the technology. So the sort of street game stuff where you're bringing the multiple mass player. I can never remember that.
It's like the flash mobs.
Multiplayer online.
Massively multiplayer online. Bringing that gameplay into real life. So you're playing games with other people via your mobile phone in the streets, and you're playing detective games. So there's like narrative stuff going on. There's walking tours and audio trails and all that kind of weaving of the technology into actual day-to-day real-life interactions with other people.
Yeah, well, I think there is a lot of slippage between content coming from one medium suddenly appearing in the other, so gameplay kind of engagement going out of a video game and then being in the streets of Hobart as people come together. But the other thing I've noticed is there's also books now being written based on forum posts.
Really?
So, yeah, there's a huge bestseller in Japan called Train Man, Densho Otoko. And I half of me thinks this is just the publisher figuring out a really clever way to pitch a book to an audience that'll sell well. I mean, it's based on a forum where a kind of nervous young boy protected a young girl from being bullied on a train, and then he went onto a forum and said, look, this girl's given me a phone number, I don't know where to go to next. And what unfolds is this kind of drama as this nervous young boy starts making these first moves to date this young girl, and all the time getting advice through forum friends. This forum post later then got published as a book and then a comic, and the book itself featured it as a forum post as well, though the whole layout of it was as if you're reading a forum. So there's really interesting slippages back into the book now, coming from new media and these online publishing.
You've mentioned a number of I think, the use of the internet. You've brought in mobile phones. You're talking about this story building up, but in little segments coming from different people. It seems to me that all these forms of communication promote brevity. So is this going to change the style and form of the stories that are going to appear in the future? Are we going to see a lot more of a focus on micro stories, for example, rather than the long novel?
I think anything that's screen-based, and the smaller the screen, the more brevity it needs. So obviously stuff on mobile phones is tighter again. Just reading content on a screen, I'm pretty sure there's been research into it that you actually absorb it less than if you read it on a printed page. Whenever people are writing for something that's going to be presented on a screen, they need to be really conscious that your audience is not going to absorb the content anywhere near the level that they would if they saw it on a printed page. So, yes, it has to be tight, it has to be clear, and I think, there is already forms of writing that are more micro stories, as they're called. I think at the same time, though, because of the restraints that the actual physical technology puts on storytelling, there will probably be a backlash against that. There will be people who desire more depth, more wordiness, more craft. Well, brevity also needs a craft, obviously. But, people will want that richer experience. And so those longer narratives will push people to books again. And they'll also be looking for more in-depth blog writing. And probably, again, with the outdoor street game type of stuff, people will actually want to have an in-depth narrative experience through some form of theatre or gaming in a real-world circumstance. So I think the brevity of online and mobile communication will actually increase the interest in longer, deeper stories. That's a personal opinion. I have no evidence for that whatsoever.
I was just going to quickly jump in about the idea of the different media kind of shortening the amount of writing. And I think it's true if you're talking about printing text and reading text that obviously there's a limited capacity for how much you want to read on a screen. Although with certain e-readers and Kindle and different ones coming out, they are always improving the technology and changing how it's lit so that it's backlit or it's lit in a different way. So it's not like reading a computer screen, it's more like reading a book. So I think technology will assist with that to make it possible for us to read longer texts. But I think just to be sure that, to make sure that people understand that when you're writing something for that's a game or writing cross-platform content, you have never written so much text in your whole life. That needs a lot of writing. So if you think about writing something that's going to be a website that's going to be interactive, you have to write the story of it. If it's a kind of narrative-based project, you have to write the story of it, but then you have to write the user experience, then you have to write all the dialogue. I think if you were writing a game document, you'd be writing maybe the equivalent of 6 novels or something like that. So it's certainly a good time to know how to write.
It's a good point that interactivity, you will actually end up writing more. I hadn't even thought about that, but every permutation of the narrative will need to be written.
I've got one more question I'd quite like to ask the panel, but I'm also conscious of the time, and I wonder if anybody in the audience has got a question they want to pose. Oh. Half the audience.
There's been a lot of talk about publishers and how you publish and all the rest of it. How much do the writers get out of all of this? How does it affect their income, and particularly if it's going to be stored for time ad infinitum, how does a record be kept of what should be paid to the writer?
I think this question of labour is really important. I mean, I'll just take it from maybe the kind of professional amateur position first, and you can pick up some aspects later. I mean, what I think is one of the really interesting questions is why is it that people are spending so much time creating all these wonderful stories on the internet for free, basically? Why aren't they trying to figure out a way to make money? Because certainly, I mean, finance and being able to not be exploited is a really important part of being a good writer or getting ahead or being able to keep being a good writer. But I think what the question opens up, and the situation facing many people that want to break into becoming successful writers or successful comic book writers or game writers, is that there's a sense of being able to use the internet at least to hone your skills, to be able to participate by putting up drafts creatively, getting a lot of creative feedback. And so a lot of people are using, I mean, there's many reasons people are putting together, say, for instance, if we just take the amateur stuff, the kind of fan fiction pieces, the fan comic book work and the fan games, is that they're using it as a way to hopefully get noticed and recognized by someone else. For instance, Madeline Rosker, the Hobart's manga artist, got noticed through her unpaid for fan work, which was appearing on Deviant.com, which is one of these big websites that a lot of the publishers visit. So a lot of publishers are trawling through these fan sites or employing their kind of underlings to trawl through these fan sites and fan communities trying to find the gem in them. So a lot of amateurs are getting their work out there. And also through that process, there's a kind of peer community within those spaces who are giving them more advice, more contacts and networks. So while there aren't any financial rewards often with these spaces and these early works, it's an amazing networking opportunity for many people. And also I think there are people that are doing it for non-financial reasons.
Well, I was just going to add in that, and then there's also the kind of standard digital rights that publishers are now increasingly packaging into their publishing deals with writers. So And that that digital publishing right may be just for ebooks, it could be for a number of different things. And I think writers are and agents and publishers are kind of at a point of negotiating these new contracts and figuring out how to make it work. And I think writers need to access more information on that and look at precedents that are being established in markets that maybe have are more advanced on with their ebook markets and that kind of thing. So even if you look at screenwriters, for example, in the US, the Writers Guild strike that happened there last year, or maybe it was 2007, was around this issue of we get a certain royalty for our work that's written for screen, but what happens when it then goes into DVD or whatever? So I think that and it's across all art forms. It's not just writers. We have performance artists who are also, and orchestras and lots of people who are thinking about how the rights that have worked for a long time and the kind of contract kind of templates that have worked for a long time, how we restructure those. And it's something we're about to start doing more work with writers on and do some kind of professional development and some seminars and get some legal people to come and talk to writers about, because it's an important issue for writers and agents to be as skilled up on as publishers.
Thanks, Therese. I've got time for just one more question here.
If one takes a 10-minute stroll up Liverpool Street on a business day and looks carefully at the people approaching you as you walk up the street. I was amazed the other day to notice over 30% of the people passing me in the street had earbuds in their ears. And I'm also interested that the audio book market is now exploding. And of course that has the advantage of not having to have the brevity of ebooks on a small screen. How do you see, I mean, there are writers now already writing directly for audiobooks. They're not going through the paper publishing stage. Do you think a time will come when all these longer texts will automatically go to an audiobook format for podcasting or whatever, so people can now read their quality text in audio form?
I think this is a very interesting question. Obviously, if authors are actually out there writing for audio book, that presumably over time will start influencing. It will become, start becoming more like radio plays almost. Maybe they'll be thinking about how the voice will sound, you know, via audio rather than, you know, how the words string together on a printed page. I think the experience is quite different. So it would be interesting to see if we start seeing new forms of novels because of that.
Look, I think that's an interesting connection with radio plays. So I think the popularity in audiobooks as well as podcasting generally is really generating a renewed interest in audio. Mm-hmm. Away from, I mean, which is a surprise to many people, I think. I mean, we're seeing a renaissance, a re-renaissance maybe, in the radio drama, in some of these forms that many people have thought of being a bygone era of the radio, being kind of calibrated or at least revalued in a positive way. And there are new opportunities with audiobooks today and that are coming out that people weren't kind of going to be able to predict. And I guess for me, the main question with the audiobook and the audio phenomenon is how we find stuff within that, like how we search within all the audio text that's now available for us to download, to listen to. So those 30% of the people with things in their ears, I mean, what are they listening to, and what where did they get that information from? I mean, it seems that in these type of programs is that it begins to suggest texts that you'd also be interested in. So with audiobooks, I think it's another leaping off point that you can find material maybe originally you wouldn't be pursuing, but suddenly you're getting suggestions saying, why don't you also listen to, you've listened to this, other people listen to this. And so it can really broaden your tastes. So I think that it could be quite a creative little experience that's quite new.
Some authors may actually prefer, as you say, to go straight to audiobook. They might prefer that as the idea of their audience listening to it. So I think it's a very interesting point.
Unfortunately, I do need to draw it to a close, but I think with audiobooks, we all like being read to, and on the thought of a bedtime story, I think we should probably thank the three panellists for their conversation.
Thank you.